Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've had fierce politics around deficit and the economy, and there is a lot at stake. But there's also a yearning for more than fierce gridlock in this country. Can we find common ground? Maybe. We're giving it a whirl with two big economists today. Bush-era economic guru Glenn Hubbard. Clinton-era fiscal miracle worker Alice Rivlin. It's not the whole range, but it's a start this hour on Point. Glenn Hubbard, Alice Rivlin, and the search for common ground on the U.S. economy. Alice Rivlin will join us in just a few minutes. We'll start with Glenn Hubbard today. He's dean of Columbia Business School in New York. From 2001 to 2003, he was chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under George W. Bush. He was a chief architect of the Bush tax cuts, which are the subject of such furious debate right now in Washington. And he's out with a new book called Seeds of Destruction, Why the Path to Economic Ruin Runs Through Washington, and How to Reclaim American Prosperity. Glenn Hubbard, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
You and your co-author, that's Peter Navarro, who, Democrat, ran for Congress, backed by Bill Clinton, are pretty apocalyptic about where we may be if we're not careful. You say America's close to a destructive tipping point, that we've got to decide whether we're going to go the way of all once great nations and suffer irreversible decline. Before we get into how we might fix it, what do you make of the point we're at, Glenn Hubbard?
Well, two things, Tom. One, we are at a potential tipping point that's not very good. We've had long-term structural problems in the country that began long before the recent financial crisis. We have an economy that was too geared to consumption, not enough to investment, trade, and growth in our future living standards. But there is a second and more optimistic point. We can fix this. There are solutions in the middle that will put the country back on a path for what Peter and I call broad-based prosperity, that is, growth that we all share in. We know how to do this, and we can come together.
You've been looking, and we've got a lot of plans out here. Alice Rivlin's just out with one yesterday with Pete Domenici, the Republican from Arizona. But, of course, Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles began showing their hand in the last week. What do you make of what you've seen on the table from these two? There have been howls all over the place, but you're generally supportive?
Well, I think the furor from both the left and the right probably means both plans are onto something, and I think both plans offer a very good marker for discussion. I don't agree with every detail of either one, but I do think they're important. If you start with Bowles-Simpson, here's a plan that says, look, we really have to get off the spending trajectory that we're on. The country can't afford it. But we need to do it in such a way that has a strong safety net government, that we take care of people who most need help. And we need a tax system that's more oriented toward growth than toward the crazy patchwork quilt we have. That's a big step. I think in the plan that Alice Rivlin offered with Senator Domenici, also some good discussion on the spending and tax side. I think it's time for politicians to come together and really come to grips with this.
You've got a couple of big proposals on the table yourself, and one has to do with mortgages and people who are underwater or in trouble. You're calling for the federal government to get in there and what lower interest rates almost across the board for mortgage holders.
Well, it's really not about a subsidy, but about going to the market. This is a short-term idea, not one of the long-term ideas in the book. But, you know, after September 2008, the government took conservatorship of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So we took the credit risk of the balance sheets. I personally wouldn't have done that, but we did it. In that boat, we could now get the government-sponsored enterprises to refinance mortgages at current market rates, which are very, very low, 4.3% or so. And that would be like a very large tax cut for many households. In normal times, we would have seen a lot of refinancing, but these are not normal times because the loan-to-value ratios are high. But this is something we could do, and it would help a lot of very upstanding homeowners.
You're not the only one who said this might be a good idea, but I haven't seen traction yet. Is there a possibility of this happening? It would be, in effect, a kind of stimulus without stimulus spending.
It's a very large stimulus, and it wouldn't cost taxpayers anything. As I say, we've already taken the credit risk on the balance sheet, and if anything, it would lower defaults. The issue does have to do with bondholders. There is no such thing as a free lunch. That's one thing all economists can agree on. And bondholders who hold mortgage-backed securities hoping that homeowners would keep paying the high interest rates would obviously take a bit of a hit. That's a small hit compared to the size of the stimulus, but it's not zero. And I think that does delay the Treasury's support.
And then before we get to the full long term, what about tax cuts? Alan Greenspan has come out and called for repeal of all the Bush tax cuts. Of course, this was back in the summer that you pushed hard for, seven, 8 years ago. There's subsequently been a huge debate in Congress about this. Let me ask you first, looking back on those tax cuts, which, you know, were set to expire, will expire December 1st, Congress has to decide what to do about it. Was it a mistake to lower taxes for everybody as we were headed into war, then two big wars, you know, and we ended that decade with enormous deficit problems? Were the tax cuts that you architected and pushed hard for a mistake?
I don't think they were a mistake, but nor do I think they're the right debate to be having right now. I think that much of what went wrong in the past decade in fiscal policy was excessive spending, and that's not a partisan comment. Republicans were just as bad, if not worse, than Democrats during much of that decade. But I think that the Bush tax cuts or the 2001-2003 code, whatever you want to call it, are not the right discussion. The right discussion is, first of all, how big do we want government to be? If we want government to be as large as in President Obama's budget, Alan Greenspan is quite right. We need to repeal all of the Bush tax cuts and then some. If we want a smaller government, we can have a different tax system. But I think as both Bowles and Simpson and Rivlin and Domenici have suggested, we need to rethink our tax system anyway. So what I would like to see is extending the current tax code for a couple of years until we're ready to have a serious conversation, probably in the 2012 campaign, about what that tax code is going to be.
You've watched Republicans, been in that camp, and watched Democrats for a long time. Part of the heat of this debate, a big part of it, rests on deeply held values or perspectives. How do you read those perspectives? What's the essential contest here in worldviews?
Well, I think that the contest can be bridged. And to your question, I think the Republican Party has tended to champion, and I think wisely so, policies that promote economic growth. Many in the Democratic Party, not all, but many, and certainly the president, have said that fairness and equity may even trump growth in their view. I think that's a false dichotomy. We can have, and indeed in this country we have had in many periods, broad-based prosperity. And we need a set of fiscal plans on the tax and spending side that do that. So I think we can have both growth and fairness. I think the proposals from Bowles and Simpson, Rivlin, Domenici are examples of that.
Democrats don't want to give up programs that support the large sectors of the society. You've written that you're also puzzled about Republicans and their sort of adamant refusal to look at any taxes when we have such a big deficit. You say the right's criticisms are more puzzling. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that if we need to pivot the economy away from being so centered on consumption to centered on investment so that we need more of a tax reform, something has to change in the tax system. For example, we probably would subsidize housing less. We might subsidize health care.
You mean the mortgage interest deduction, I guess.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And you could call that a tax increase, but I would call it part of a healthy pivot in the economy. So I guess I'm a little puzzled there. Likewise, on the left, I'm concerned that if we say we can't make any changes in these programs, the tax increases that would be required would kill the economy. A better way, it seems to me, is say let's make our entitlement programs principally safety net programs. Let's even strengthen the benefits for low-income people, but not for middle and upper-income people.
And you're saying you see that in the Bowles-Simpson plan, for example.
I do. It's not exactly the way I would do it, but I see that as at least a marker for discussion. And going back to that bigger budget point you and I were talking about a moment ago in talking about the size of government, we've got to decide with entitlements. Do we want a safety net government or do we want a welfare state? The country can afford the former. It can't afford the latter.
What about with your call for a shift to focus on investment rather than consumption? What does that mean? I mean, people talk about fairness and equity, and these are a big deal. We have not been this inequitable in terms of distribution of income and wealth in a long, long time. The top 1% of Americans own 34% of America's private net worth. That puts us in league, or Nick Kristof is writing just today, that makes us worse than a lot of Latin American countries were in the days when we called them banana republics. Does your outlook have the seeds of turning that around?
I think it does. First of all, it is a real problem, and it's one that we ought to be concerned about. And it's about raising the skills of a large set of the population and also encouraging business growth and dynamism. The way to do that is complicated. There's no silver bullet. One element is a set of tax policies that encourages investment and small business formation, but also policies that encourage innovation and skill development. I think this is complicated, but we can do this. We have had broad-based prosperity in the country before, and we can have it again.
That inequity grew during the Bush administration that you were part of. Why?
Well, we've had a development in the past, I'd say 25 years, mm-hmm. almost continuously, of increases in income inequality. Much of that comes from the returns to very high-skilled occupations being so high relative to the returns of lower-skilled occupations. It's both a skill-based argument and something that's reinforced by globalization. We can rail against it, or we can try to help the least well-off among us succeed. That's what we should do.
We've been talking with Glenn Hubbard. He's dean at the Columbia Business School. Was right in the middle of the Bush administration, chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush in his first term, a chief architect of the Bush tax cuts that are at the heart of so much controversy right now. He joins us from New York. We're now joined as well from Washington by Alice Rivlin. She was in the Clinton administration as director and deputy director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a professor at Georgetown University. She and Republican Pete Domenici are co-chairs of a bipartisan deficit reduction task force, which unveiled its own set of proposals just yesterday. Alice Rivlin, thank you very much for being with us.
Delighted to be here, Tom. So, and hi, Glenn.
Hi, Alice. How are you?
Hi, everybody. Erskine and Allen got their share of fireworks when they put their plan out. Yours is out now, also put forward as bipartisan. It's catching some grief for regressive sales tax, value-added tax. What are you proposing, Alice?
We are proposing a balanced plan. We certainly agree with Glenn's analysis, Glenn and Peter Navarro, that this economy is headed for deep, deep trouble. We're going off a cliff if we don't do something. We have looming debt increases that have to be conquered or we're going to be in real trouble. So with that background, Pete Domenici and I organized an effort with 19 people from across the country. They were Republicans and Democrats, former office holders, and budget experts, mm-hmm. and put together over a year of conversation a balanced plan for addressing the deficit and debt problem. The first thing to do is keep the debt from rising so fast. It's on track to get bigger than the whole economy. We suggest stabilizing the debt at around 60% of the economy, of the GDP, and then bringing it down. And that will bring the annual deficits down to a manageable level as well. We believe you have to operate on both sides of the budget. There have to be substantial continuing spending cuts, both in discretionary spending, defense and domestic, and in the long-run entitlement programs, especially health care has to be reined in.
You've got a little stimulus up front here, Alice, if I may. Sorry.
We do. But you have some stimulus.
Nobody will pay the payroll tax for the next year or so if you
That is our suggestion. We think, actually, the economy faces two big problems. One is getting back to higher employment. Without that, we can't solve the deficit problem. And the current recovery is weak, so we think it should be jump-started with a major tax cut, a temporary one. Mm-hmm. We think that a payroll tax holiday for a year would be a good stimulus to the economy. It would put money in the pockets of all wage earners, everybody who pays payroll tax, and most people pay more payroll tax than income tax. But we would also extend it to employers to give them some incentive to hire.
There's a stimulus, and then you get right in on spending, and you include defense spending in your freeze. You've got a non-defense and defense spending freeze. How does that work?
Well, we do. We think that these have to be started simultaneously. You can't have the dessert first and then not take the medicine. We think that a package of deficit reduction should be put in place right away and that will help the recovery. It's sometimes thought that these two things, helping the recovery and solving the deficit problem, are antithetical. We don't think so. We think as long as you phase the deficit reduction in slowly and have a stimulus like the payroll tax holiday up front, that both are conducive to longer run growth. What does a freeze mean? It means exactly that. It means that both on the domestic side and on the defense side, the total discretionary spending, as it's called, the amount that's appropriated every year, will not rise. The Defense Department will have to find savings and reorient their priorities. There's a lot of waste in defense. And similarly, on the domestic side, there are lots of things that the domestic side of the government needs to spend for, but there are some things we could spend less on. So a freeze just means figure out within a fixed total how to spend on the highest priorities.
Glenn Hubbard,
and then we reform the tax system.
Right. We'll look at that. Glenn Hubbard says that this country has to choose. I'm interested in your response between having a safety net and a welfare state. Do you accept that sort of paradigm for thinking about the decisions we're facing? And what do you do on entitlements, Social Security, Medicare?
I don't think that Glenn and I agree exactly on that. I do believe in social insurance. I think the Social Security system is actually a very successful program. It keeps millions of older people out of poverty. It needs to be shored up. It doesn't need major change, but if we don't put the Social Security system on a firm financial basis so it can keep on paying benefits, we will have people now in the labor force who won't even be certain that they will get their Social Security. So we propose a combination of things, raising the cap to which the Social Security tax applies. Mm-hmm. It's now $106,000. We would raise it faster than it's on track to go. And we would restructure the benefits so that upper income people or upper wage earners don't get quite as much and lower wage earners get more. We don't change the age in our plan, the age of retirement, which is very controversial, but we do index the benefits to longevity. That means as people on the average are living longer and drawing benefits longer, those benefits would be slightly reduced.
There's a lot to this, but just for the moment, finally, on the sales tax front, this value-added tax, what are you introducing, a kind of federal sales tax? How big, for how long, and why?
Federal sales tax, 6.5%.
On top of state sales taxes. So that would be a real jump.
It would be a real jump, but it wouldn't be European level either. But the sales tax has to be seen in conjunction with the drastic reform of the income tax that we propose. We think the income tax is just a terribly unfair and inefficient tax. We should essentially blow it up and start over. We think that if you get rid of most of the deductions and exemptions and exclusions, you can bring the rates down. We suggest a two-rate system, 15 and 27. But we would make the system progressive by having an earnings credit and a child credit. So the system would actually be more progressive than the current system, and that offsets the regressive effect of the sales tax.
So let me ask you, and we'll take it to Glenn Hubbard. I mean, you worked with Pete Domenici on this. Now we've got the Bowles and Simpson's plan out there. But, of course, there's a great big spectrum here. I mean, maybe to the right of Glenn, there's Tea Party folks who say no taxes, and they've got a lot of people signed on that. Glenn's saying that's a little puzzling, given that we've got a deficit. To the left of you, you've got really tough progressives who say it's not time to compromise. It's time to fight. We're in a sort of battle for the American people here. Do you think that there is common ground that we can sidestep gridlock and get an agreement on here that would be effective, Alice?
I do think so. I wouldn't be spending a lot of my life working on this project. I'm on both the President's
Yes.
Commission with Simpson Bowles and have been working with Pete Domenici. So it's a kind of a full-time job now, and I believe in it. I believe there is common ground. Now, the fact that we're getting the extreme right and some of the extreme left sniping at us, I think, is kind of encouraging. Because people are beginning to focus on the problem, and the encouraging part is in the middle. Even Jan Schakowsky, who's on one of my colleagues on the president's commission, and who's quite liberal, put out a plan yesterday. It's a different plan. It's a more liberal plan, but she is taking the problem seriously, and that's good.
Glenn, what about on your right? I mean, the Tea Party crowd has got a lot of congressmen, Republican congressmen, signed on to a pledge, zero new taxes of any kind, no way, no how. What about it? Can you bring them in?
I think you can. I agree with Alice 100%. I think you have to start with the word principle spelled two ways. And, you know, we need to agree on the size of budget cuts, so principle PAL, and I think both sides can talk about those numbers. And then principle PLE, we've got to pivot toward economic growth and maintain fairness. And once you get that in the mix, I think plans like the two markers you've talked about, like a lot of other good ideas, have to be where to go. And I think right now, I agree with Alice, this is fulmination on the two ends of the spectrum. But eventually, people will see to solve these two problems, they got to come together.
Let's hear from our listeners what they're hearing, what they think. Caleb in Somerville, Massachusetts. Caleb, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I'd like to address some comments of both of your guests in terms of, especially Mr. Hubbard, in his claim of the need for fairness with broad-based growth. Now,
yes.
I would look at two examples of that, one in American history and one in abroad, one in the Johnson era. During this period, we had the lowest rate of unemployment that the U.S. has ever seen in 67 to 69, between 3.3 and 3.4%. Also during that period, minimum wage, of course, was at its highest real value, topping at $9.86 in mm-hmm. current U.S. dollars, 1968, which is about 50% of median income, whereas today it's dropped down to about 30-something
mm-hmm.
percent. And we had a very highly progressive income tax, something in the high 70s for the top marginal bracket, and yet our economy was growing, productivity and was rising with wages, whereas since productivity has been rising, wages have stagnated. And I would also, my second example is Germany today, where you have a much higher base cost of labor than the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and yet they maintain 47% of GDP with exports, whereas U.S. has only 12-something percent. They also are the second largest exporter in the world with a population of 82 million, whereas U.S. is behind
mm-hmm.
them with
right.
a population of 307 million. So and they're now in the high fives, low sixes, during the past couple of months in unemployment, whereas we're still depression era rate unemployment or early 80s, or how have you.
So your question, Caleb, why not these models here and now for the USA?
Yes, why not? And now in Germany, we have a much higher progressive tax system. They also have universal health care, funding for higher education, a much lower defense budget.
It's a great question, and I'm glad for the way you framed it, and I will put it to both Glenn Hubbard and Alice Rivlin. But Glenn, first to you. Caleb says, come on, why
sure,
not? There it is.
It's a great question, and I think it illustrates, you know, that so many things go on in an economy, it's hard to make the comparison. Germany, of course, isn't looking at a very healthy long-term fiscal picture with very unpleasant demographics and entitlement issues. The productivity point, let's be careful. Compensation is roughly rising with productivity. Wages aren't. And why is that? In no small part, very rising health care costs. So all of these pieces have to be tackled. I think the real point, and there's several policy models to do it, and Caleb's brought up some very interesting examples, is we need something that focuses on unleashing growth but sharing prosperity. And the sharing has to come both from investing in skills and supporting lower income people through tax policy and through entitlements.
Are you talking – is this trickle down again or what's the framework?
No, I would think of it as broad-based prosperities. It's the U.S. Growth in much of the 50s and 60s. I think it's very strong top-line growth in the economy. We've been blessed still in recent years with very high productivity growth. The question is inclusion. The right way to get inclusion is not punishing tax policies. The right way to get inclusion is investing in skills and strengthening the incomes of people who fall below an acceptable income level.
Alice Rivlin, you hear our caller Caleb's yearning for, you know, something for everybody here and looking at models that to many Americans seem painfully distant from this country right now.
I'd like to mention a more recent model, and that was the 90s, when the economy grew very strongly and we had very low unemployment rates, below 4% at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And what we learned from that, I think, is low unemployment is very good for wages at the bottom and for people moving up. People who hadn't had jobs, got skills. There was enormous incentive on the part of employers and employees to get more skill and move up, and you could afford to do that in that period. I share with Caleb his view that the tax system should be more progressive. I would not do that by raising the rates, though. I think that's not good for the economy.
Helping.
I would do a thorough overhaul, as we suggest in our proposal, the proposal I've done with Domenici. And the way you get more progressivity is you do things like turning the home mortgage deduction, which benefits very heavily high-income people, into a credit at the 15% rate. That means everybody who's a homeowner gets to deduct up to a limit. It's much more favorable to low-income people and less to upper-income people. A series of examples like that could increase taxation at the top, but make the tax system much fairer and much more pro-growth.
So I couldn't agree more.
Well, then I wonder if you too could sit down and come to agreement. You've got wings on either side who might not, but could you too? Alice, do you think you could sit with Glenn and sort of hammer out something as you did with Pete Domenici? Or is there a hard
nut
of disagreement here at the heart of this about the fate of different classes and millions of Americans?
I don't think there's a hard nut of disagreement. We might have some disagreements on some things. I think probably Glenn would means test the entitlements more aggressively than I would. I believe in the social insurance approach. And one thing I know we disagree on is taxation of capital gains as ordinary income. One way I would make the system more progressive in our new tax system would be to include capital gains as ordinary income. I don't think Glenn would favor that, but those are details.
Let's get a call right here from Nashville, Tennessee. Jim, you're on the air with Glenn Hubbard and Alice Rivlin.
Hello. I'm not schooled in economics, but I've got concerns about the principles that we seem to be forsaking, things such as the people who know what's going on at the local level are the local people, and the more we centralize at the national level programs and so forth, we're going to not be able to keep track of who the people are that really are in need and who the people are who have made life choices to hamstring themselves but are still demanding that they be taken care of. If we take away the negative incentives towards certain behaviors or life choices,
that cause people to find themselves in delicate situations, then we're going to only see people continuing to make those choices.
Jim, are you then are you saying no thanks to safety nets in this country?
I'm saying no thanks to centralizing them nationally. I think the place for safety nets is the local level, where people can discern whether those seeking help have made good choices and just come upon bad circumstances, or whether those people have continually made choices, self-destructive choices, but still demand society to care for them perpetually.
Jim, I appreciate your call. Glenn, how far do you want to go on this front? You don't want what you call a welfare state. Others might just call it a full safety net. I don't know. Jim wants to take it all the way back to, you know, folks around town who know who's living right and who's not, and then they decide who deserves support. I mean, how far do you go?
I think he tees up a very interesting question. Certainly in the area of health care reform, many market-oriented reforms to change incentives and get more skin in the game do emphasize personal responsibility and behavior. That was definitely an agenda the country had with very successful welfare reform, too. But I do stick with my guns, or buy my guns on a strong safety net. It certainly has to be financed at the national level. I don't deny the importance of local charity and organizations. I think it's critically important, but I do think we need a strong national safety net.
Alice, there's been this sort of when Bull Simpson came out, there was the complaint that between getting rid of the mortgage deduction and other entitlements shaved on, that we may be dismantling the scaffolding of the middle class in this country. Are we at risk of doing that as we grapple with this fiscal situation we're in?
No, I don't think so. I think we're trying to enhance the opportunities for everybody, but especially for the middle class. I agree with some of the things the caller says. I've been a longtime advocate of more responsibility closer to the voter. But I would stick with major programs like Social Security, which I think has been a very successful program, and that it wouldn't be better if it were run at the local level.
Let's go to Jan in Bourne, Massachusetts. Jan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I wanted to return to the fairness question, Nicholas Kristof's column, and
the Banana Republic allegation.
That's right. And I'm trying to understand the conservative economic philosophy here. And so my question goes to Mr. Hubbard. Are there any circumstances in which, let's say, if we fast forward 20, 30 years, and the top 1% now has, north of 40% of all income, at that point, does the conservative mindset allow us to revisit redistribution of some of that income through tax policy?
Glenn Hubbard.
Well, there's no question that we already have redistribution through the tax system, and I think both Alice and I have talked about maintaining or perhaps even enhancing redistribution. The question is, how do you do it? In my mind, a lot of that is accomplished on the spending side, where we have very generous entitlement spending for very upper-income people that I would question whether that's a very good use of taxpayer money. The real puzzle to me, or biggest concern to me, is poverty more than it is inequality. The question is how – I don't lose a lot of sleep over billionaires. I lose a lot of sleep over people struggling. And the question is how to get those skills. And I've never seen a persuasive argument that says simply taxing the rich is the way to do it. Rather, the way to do it is investment, it's growth, and it's education.
Why didn't those people do better then during the W. Bush administration? You were part of it. You were in there. Why didn't they do better then?
Well, I think we have had this trend for 25 or 30 years of increasing compression of incomes for low-skilled workers. It is a policy concern, and the way to do it is not to hold back tides of trade or of trying to punish entrepreneurs. I think the real issue is how to give people the skills they need, and there's no silver bullet for doing it. Healthcare reform is also vitally important because it is what's holding back wage growth for a lot of people, even though the compensation bill for employers is growing.
Let's get it down to brass tacks then. You engineered the Bush tax cut that everybody's grappling with now. President Obama's position was that the tax cuts for the richest Americans should not be extended. It would cost us, will cost us, if it happens, $700 billion over the next decade. We've got a big deficit. You know, the argument is that just doesn't make sense. What do you say now? Would you extend the tax cuts for the most affluent Americans that you designed?
The truth is, as I said to you earlier, Tom, I think we should extend the entire tax code for 2 years until we're ready to have a conversation about the size of government and about tax reform. President Obama is disingenuous if he really believes that tax increases are necessary to achieve his spending level. He'd have to repeal all of the Bush tax cuts, and his own advisors know it. Peter Orszag, his budget director, wrote as much in the New York Times. So I think the real question is not the parsing of the Bush tax cuts. The real question is how big do we want government to be and what kind of tax system we want to have? Bowles Simpson, Rivlin Domenici, they get at those questions. President Obama's riposte does not.
Alice Rivlin, you've got a longer-term plan here, but there is a decision right now in front of Congress. Would you extend the tax cuts, the $700 billion worth, of the next if it went for the next decade of the most wealthy Americans?
Not permanently. My preferred position is extend the tax cuts for 2 years, except for the people at the very top, and you can argue what the very top is, but certainly people are earning over $1 million don't need any more help. But the important thing is temporary, and I think Glenn's right about this. We shouldn't give away all that revenue on a permanent basis. We need to think about how to raise revenue more efficiently and more progressively, as I believe our plan would do.
Let's go to Burlington, Vermont, and Bob. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to, you know, kind of comment right back to the topic of the show today. You know, is there that common ground?
Yeah.
You know, as they say, you know, there's more than one cat. Both parties really have, you know, good plans, I think, to fix the economy. The problem that we have is bipartisan politics is just so violent nowadays that no party will anyway go near a plan if the other party has brought it out. I think, you know, it's good evidence of that is with President Obama saying, yes, okay, let's compromise on these Bush-era tax cuts. And then Democrats immediately popping out saying, absolutely not. No, no, no. We are not going to compromise on that. And that's coming, you know, from within his own party. I'm just kind of wondering what your speakers had to say in regards to that.
Bob, I appreciate your call. Alice, first whack at that. I mean, you've seen the politics that have unfolded since you were in the Clinton White House. They were tough then. They're tougher now. How do you get around that?
It's a terribly partisan atmosphere, but I'm always hopeful. And I've sat in the meetings of the President's Commission as recently as yesterday. That's a bipartisan group, and the conversation was very substantive and very collegial. This is a group of people trying to find an acceptable way to address the looming debt. The conversations in our group, the Bipartisan Policy Center, were similar, although we weren't running for public office. And I believe that the Obama administration really wants to find common ground, and that on the specific case of the tax cut extensions, I think they'll find it. Something will happen. Nobody is going to want to let those tax cuts expire in the middle of a recession, so they'll find some common ground.
Glenn Hubbard, how about it? The Obama administration is there right now. We've got a Republican majority coming into the House. You see the players. You know, everybody's got ideas. You do, Alice does, others. But is there the political chemistry to make something happen here?
Well, I think we're going to know soon. The markers that were put down by Bowles and Simpson and by Alice and Senator Domenici show that in a good bipartisan group, you can have a great discussion. Whether you agree on every little thing, you can put that aside, but it's a great discussion and a great marker. President Obama's got the next move. Presidents have to lead. Big tax changes, big spending changes, the leadership has to come out of the White House. And so I think we will learn soon when we hear President Obama's response. After all, one of these was his own commission, and we'll see what he thinks.
How are you going to gauge that? I mean, you, in your book, Seeds of Destruction, are really tough on the president. I mean, the seeds of destruction, you're saying, were planted by Barack Obama, by President Obama. Clive Crook in the Financial Times, you know, not exactly Pravda, says you've got a good and useful book, but bipartisan it is not. He says the attack on the Obama administration's fiscal stimulus, for example, calls far too harsh. He says the tone is off-puttingly militant. I mean, are you part of the polarized picture, Glenn Hubbard?
No, I don't think I look terribly militant. I mean, we're certainly as critical of President Bush in the book, particularly for the very high Medicare spending and the loss of spending control. But I think the issue is more not to point fingers at one party or the other, but just to ask whoever the president is to lead. And I think to me what that means is President Obama coming out and say, I heard you, and here's a set of things that I think I could get behind for the long term. Neither of these proposals is asking for draconian changes in the short term. They're asking for a clear path. And indeed, in Alice's case, even some short-term stimulus that's well worth the president's consideration. If he doesn't respond seriously to this, then I think it's an indication that he doesn't plan to lead on this topic.
We're looking at the search for common ground on the U.S. fiscal future, the U.S. economy. Let's go to St. Augustine, Florida, and Chris. Chris, you're on the air.
Hello. My question to your guests, and I like to say they all make terrific points, but we have been devastated by the Chinese in manufacturing. We will not bring back employment until we bring back manufacturing. How would you address the Chinese invasion?
Let us pick it up. Glenn Hubbard, your co-author, wrote on this. Peter Navarro, what did he write? Something about the Chinese crisis or the Chinese attack?
Well, and we talk in the book about China as well. First of all, you're absolutely right that the country needs a healthy manufacturing sector that is not just important for raw employment but also for the kind of shop floor innovation that keeps a country strong. I think in our country's case, there are big issues and smaller issues. The really big issue is we have had a policy encouraging too much consumption, too little saving. China, by contrast, is the other way around. They actually need more domestic demand and probably a little bit less pushing of exports. And those two big macro policies have definitely hurt us. At the more micro level, our uncompetitive corporate tax, our litigation system, rising health care costs, all of those things have made the situation worse. But I agree with you. It's an important issue. Our dealings with China as a country ought not to be about bullying the Chinese. It ought to be about China to do what's in its interest, which is to increase its own domestic demand, and in our country to take the strong steps, as both Bowles Simpson and Rivlin Domenici would do, of increasing saving.
Alice Rivlin, do you see a consensus on free trade that was hammered out over time? There were always dissenters, but it was hammered out, and it gained dominance. Do you see it coming apart, unraveling under this economic pressure right now and this numbers we're looking at?
I hope not. I agree with what Glenn just said, but I think if the answers here that come out of the frustration are to close down trade, to raise tariff barriers, things like that, that we thought we'd gotten away from, we will all be poorer. We need, as Glenn said, to pressure the Chinese very hard in their own long-run interest to move away from such an export-led economy and such an investment-led economy. They need to do more consuming. But we don't control them. We do control us. And we have to move our economy more toward saving, less toward consumption, more toward investment. And there's certainly some ways we can do that.
Last call from Florence in West Hartford, Connecticut. Florence, you're on the air.
Yes. My point is that I wrote in the town of West Hartford, the point is we are top-heavy. The Bush administration took care of the wealthy. The paraprofessionals went from a class, one para in the classroom, to no paras, just maybe one doing everything, which was happening to me at 77 years old. Also, the fact that everyone, the young first man that talked about people who are not responsible. Hi, group. I've called before, and if you look back at my record, all my life has been to do the right thing and no handout.
But it looks top-heavy to you. That is, higher earners in a better position. Alice, how do we get over that? A lot of people are worried about that here right now. How do you turn that around? Is there common ground for turning that around?
Well, it looks top-heavy to me, too, and I think the fact that the high earners, and especially the financial services industry, have made so much money, a lot of it more in trading stocks than in doing a productive investment. That all worries me very much. But I do think the answers lie in addressing this looming public deficit problem, without which we can't do anything, and revamping our tax code and revamping our health system so that it's more effective and less costly.
How much time do we have, Alice? You talk about going over a cliff. A cliff is a line. Where is it? How much time do we have to get something together here?
We don't know exactly, but as you look at the European situation and see one country after another, albeit small countries, we're not Greece, we're not Ireland, we're not Portugal, but these are warning signs that if we don't get our looming debt under control and get our economy moving again, we're in trouble.
Alice Rivlin and Glenn Hubbard, we're grateful to each of you for being with us today. Thank you so much. Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.